From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Barney Frank is one of two openly gay United States congressmen. On today's Fresh Air, we'll talk to the Massachusetts representative about President Clinton's new policy on gays in the military and about Frank's own coming out. Also today, the king of the surf guitar, Dick Dale, tells us about creating the thick, staccato, reverberating sound that influenced everyone from the Beach Boys to Sonic Youth. And we have another journal entry from Anne Lamott about her son and the death of a friend's infant. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Israel stepped up its air and artillery attacks on southern Lebanon today, trying to strike back at Arab guerrillas who've been firing rockets at settlements in northern Israel. Israeli military officials said that one Israeli soldier was killed and three were wounded in an attack on the strip of south Lebanon that Israel occupies as a self-declared security zone. The Iranian-backed Hezbollah guerrilla group said its forces destroyed a tank and killed or wounded Israeli soldiers in the attack. The United Nations Security Council is discussing penalizing Croatia for its continued campaign against Muslims in Bosnia. NPR's Anne Gerrels has more.
Once allies of the Muslims against the Serbs, the Croats are now working with the Serbs to clean Muslims out of areas they hope will be theirs under a future peace plan. At their recent meeting in Tokyo, the major industrialized nations warned Croatia it could face sanctions if it continued to expand the war in Bosnia. Today, State Department spokesman Michael McCurry acknowledged Croatian behavior has not improved since that warning. If anything, he said, the situation may have gotten somewhat worse. As a result, the Security Council has begun talks in applying economic sanctions, though no decisions have yet been made. Contrary to earlier plans, McCurry said U.S. Special Envoy Reginald Bartholomew will attend the Geneva peace talks due to begin tomorrow. This was at the request of Bosnian President Alija Izetbegovic. But McCurry stressed the focus is very much on what the parties themselves now address. I'm Ann Gerrels in Washington.
President Clinton said today that America could be more competitive if businesses would build better relationships with their employees. The president was addressing a jobs conference in Chicago. NPR's Jackie Lydon reports.
The conference was held at the Sheraton Hotel, significant because in 1992, 10,000 people stood in line here in freezing temperatures for just 1,000 jobs. Today's conference, which the president addressed, seeks to spotlight those companies which have cooperative relationships between management and labor, both union and non-union. The president was accompanied by Labor Secretary Robert Reich and Secretary of Commerce Ron Brown, who've been in Chicago since Sunday. The idea, said Reich, is to use this conference as a bully pulpit. One union leader, speaking to the president at a roundtable today, said that if all companies were as good as those represented here, there would be fewer problems in American business because these companies are the high road. I'm Jackie Lydon in Chicago.
Stock prices rose sharply today on Wall Street, with the blue chip issues hitting a new record. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 21 points to close at a record 3,567.7. The NASDAQ was up 4.3 points at 704.54. Advancing issues led declines by a slight margin in heavy trading. This is NPR. Emergency workers and volunteers are working to shore up levees along the Mississippi River in preparation for a record crest predicted for early next week. The National Weather Service now anticipates that the river will crest for a third time at a record 48 feet. People have been working at the levees for a month, but experts say the long period of high water threatens to saturate the levees and weaken them. At least 42 people have died in 6 weeks of flooding, and damage estimates now range as high as $12 billion. A toxic chemical leak 15 miles east of San Francisco has sent hundreds of people to hospital emergency rooms for treatment. NPR's Elaine Corey reports from San Francisco.
A seal on a railroad tank car burst at about 7:30 this morning local time, releasing a huge cloud of sulfuric acid over parts of San Francisco's East Bay. The leak was capped some 4 hours later after police evacuated an industrial area and closed portions of nearby freeways. Sulfuric acid is an irritant to the eyes, nose, and lungs. Health officials warned residents to stay inside and seal doorways and windows. At local hospitals, about 300 people are being treated, mostly for burning eyes and throats. The toxic cloud is now moving northeast and dissipating. Spokesmen for the General Chemical Corporation say they will cooperate with local agencies to determine the cause of the leak. In San Francisco, I'm Elaine Corey.
UN commanders in Bosnia said today that their troops will retaliate against ethnic Serbian troops if they attack a UN base again. An attack took place yesterday as French UN peacekeepers set up a position in Sarajevo. The UN commanders say their troops were surprised before they had a chance to unpack weapons. The Serbs have claimed that the attack was the work of Muslim fighters trying to provoke a fight between the Serbs and the UN. UN commanders dismissed that claim. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new policy on gays in the military goes into effect October 1st. My guest, Congressman Barney Frank, is one of two openly gay members of the U.S. Congress. He opposed the ban on gays in the military, but was willing to accept a compromise which would have allowed gays to express their sexuality only when they were off duty. But the new policy states that homosexual conduct on base or off base is grounds for discharge. In the past, military investigations into sexual orientation have been compared to witch hunts. The new policy says inquiries can only be initiated when there is credible information that there's a basis for discharge. We invited Congressman Frank to talk with us about being a gay member of Congress during the debate. Frank is a Democrat from Massachusetts who served in the House since 1980. President Clinton says the new policy provides a sensible balance between the rights of the individual and the needs of our military to remain the world's number one fighting force. I asked Congressman Frank if he sees the new policy as an advancement.
I do, but I don't agree with the president's statement, and I do wish he hadn't said that. I don't blame Bill Clinton for the fact that those of us who wanted a complete lifting of the ban didn't have the political strength to succeed. Compromise is sometimes inevitable in politics. The big mistake, though, is to try and talk people into believing that you hadn't compromised. I think it was Hannah Arendt who said that the problem with choosing the lesser evil is sometimes you forget that you've still chosen evil. And I think that's applicable in this case. It's not a good policy. It is a less bad policy than the one we've had in this sense. If it is carried out in the spirit in which the president and his chief aides have promulgated it, and as I believe at least the leadership of the Joint Chiefs have promulgated it, in practice it will mean a good deal less harassment and oppression for gay men and lesbians. That is, it is not a policy which represents any great improvement in theory, but the way they have structured it, with restrictions on what triggers investigations, with limits on who can start an investigation within the military service, with the whole notion being that this was an intention to reduce the anti-gay and lesbian atmosphere, all those things together, I think, will make it very likely that you'll see far fewer gay men and lesbians victimized by the policy. But it's still an inappropriate policy. And in particular, I didn't like the formulation that the president used, that we needed to strike a balance between letting gay men and lesbians serve and the need to keep the military in good shape, because I don't regard those as conflicting objectives.
Have you seen the RAND report that the Pentagon commissioned that concluded that gay men and lesbians could serve openly in the armed forces if that policy was given strong support from the military's senior leaders?
I have seen a summary of its conclusions, and I do believe that it ought to be released. There is absolutely no reason whatsoever for the Pentagon to hold it up. The RAND Corporation is a group that has a long history of working very collaboratively with the military. They are not people whom anyone has ever argued had an anti-military bias. The fact that RAND said that, it goes back to what I said before when you quoted the president's statement that he had achieved the right balance between the needs of the military and the rights of people not to be discriminated against. And as I said, those are not things that are in conflict. And the RAND Corporation study says that, and many of us are going to continue to press until that is released, because this fight isn't over. This is step one.
What's the next step, then?
Well, the next step, there are several next steps that we'll be taking simultaneously. One, the court cases will proceed. There have been court cases that predate this, and the court cases will proceed. The administration presumably will have a new rationale in some of the cases, but those court cases will go forward. Secondly, there will be the implementation phase, and we'll have to see how faithfully the military leadership and followers implement a policy that is supposed to, according to the administration, mean less harassment and less oppression of gay men and lesbians. Finally, this will recur in the political situation. What we've got, and this is one reason why I think this was in advance, although it was far less of an advance than I had hoped. Until recently, we didn't even have the support to have a debate on this. This policy that gays and lesbians were excluded had really not been terribly controversial in the country. Some of us had been agitating about it, and we began to get Secretary Dick Cheney and even General Powell to acknowledge that there were some problems with it, Secretary Cheney in particular. But until Bill Clinton got elected president, this debate couldn't have happened. It has begun. The outcome at this stage is not a happy one for me because the ban, in theory, has largely been kept in place, although, as I say, I think lessened in practice. But that's now a debate that's open, and we're not going to stop this. We don't do this in civil rights issues in America, whether it's race or sex or any of these issues. We often have to start with a small gain because encrusted and longstanding prejudices acquire a kind of a strength just from having been there. People don't like to admit that they've been wrong. People have unreasonable fears about people who've been discriminated against, and it takes a while to break them down. The RAND report, I believe, will be helpful in that debate, and that's why I think it ought to be released.
It strikes me that you were in what might have been a very uncomfortable position for you. You've been really wanting a Democratic president in the White House for a long time. You supported President Clinton in trying to overturn the ban, but you think he accepted a compromise that didn't go far enough. In your book, Speaking Frankly, which was published a couple of years ago, you wrote, if someone were to write a musical about the Democratic Party of the last generation, it would be called How to Win Everything in Politics Except the Presidency. So how do you feel now that you have a Democrat in the White House and yet on one of the first big issues that he's been tested on, you feel like he went too far in compromising?
I feel very pleased that we have a president. You can't seriously be asking me if I expected that once a Democratic president was elected, everything would go exactly as I want. I mean, frankly, that's not a tough issue to deal with. Presidents have a lot of power in our society. They are necessary conditions for winning on big issues, but they're not sufficient conditions. Abortion is a very important issue to me. I think the right of a woman to be free from legal threat if she decides to terminate a pregnancy, that's a very important issue, and it's one that I've supported all my political life. Now, having Bill Clinton as president instead of George Bush or Ronald Reagan is a very great advance from that standpoint, but it's not everything. Despite Bill Clinton, we still had the House of Representatives adopt the Hyde Amendment, with which I very much disagreed, which says, yes, you can have an abortion if you are able to afford one, but if you are a poor a woman on welfare, you can't have one, most likely, or it will be very hard for you to have one. Now, Bill Clinton being president didn't mean that all of the issues involving abortion got resolved, but it did make it much better. And I think that's the mature way to look at these things. The president being elected, who is of your party, doesn't mean you get everything you had hoped for, but it does mean significant advances. We are now debating whether or not there was any real gain in this policy on gays and lesbians in the military. I think the very fact that we have had the debate, and the debate was one in which the defenders of the policy were, in fact, on the defensive. That's a great advance. When we had Republican presidents, we couldn't even raise this issue. There are, of course, other areas, as I said, in the gay and lesbian rights area where Bill Clinton has been enormously positive, appointing people who are openly gay or lesbian to public policy positions, helping them get confirmed by the Senate. That's a great advance. Increasing AIDS research funding by nearly 25%, which Bill Clinton did. Some of the things that Clinton has done that have been very advantageous from my standpoint, people don't know about as much because we were able to do them, frankly, fairly easily. And inevitably, what happens in society is issues get attention not because of their intrinsic importance, but whether or not they're controversial. If something happens that's really quite important, but there's not a big fight about it, people don't pay much attention.
Do you think that there are special pressures on you in an issue like this pertaining to gay rights because you are gay and out and in the Congress?
Yes, I'm sure there are. One of them, frankly, is that people in the media only want to talk to me about gay rights, and sometimes I find that frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
Gay rights is a very important issue to me, and I work hard at it. I work hard on trying to alleviate poverty, on trying to cut excessive military spending, on trying to stimulate the economy through better banking practices. And in that sense, yeah, the danger, I think, is that people who are in my district will get an inaccurate impression, not through their fault, but through the media, which will focus too much on one part of what I do and give people the impression that the part is the whole.
I wonder if you internalize opposition on an issue like this, where you interpret it as homophobia if people are against changing the military rules on gays. If it's different from talking about, say, banking or an economic policy, if you feel that it's almost, you know, if it's more personal to you.
Well, you have to separate that out. I think that people are racist sometimes when they oppose things that are fair for African Americans, and I think sometimes people are anti-women when they block fair treatment for women. So, yes, this is more personal to me, and I may feel it more intensely in some cases, but I work very hard at not having that color my judgment. Questions of discrimination against gay men and lesbians are different than banking questions or housing questions, but they're not different than race questions or questions of sex discrimination. And I, all my life, and certainly all through my electoral career, have been very much concerned with discrimination. I've been a big supporter of the Equal Rights Amendment and very much opposed to discrimination against women. I went to Mississippi in the summer of 1964 to protest against the terrible oppression, the worst oppression in American history that we've seen against the black people of Mississippi. It was un-American the way people were mistreated there. I've been a strong supporter of the Americans with Disabilities Act. I've worked hard on behalf of people with mental illness. So in that sense, I think I can say that I've been fairly consistently outraged by unfairness. I really believe very strongly every American ought to be treated on his or her merits. And now, being one of two gay members of Congress who's been willing to get into the middle of this fight, yeah, that can sometimes generate some pressures, particularly in terms of media attention. But while I may feel oppression against gay men more being gay, I don't think, if you look at my record, you'll see that I have differentiated in my efforts to combat that kind of prejudice from my efforts against race prejudice, gender prejudice, or anti-Semitism. I'm also Jewish, and while anti-Semitism, fortunately, is far less of a factor in the society than it used to be, on those occasions when it is a factor, obviously that's something that also engages my interest very strongly.
I'm wondering if there are a lot of congressmen who'd come up to you and say, listen, I have nothing against gays, but we can't budge on this policy.
Well, it depends on when and how they say it. Not when, but what's the basis? I have colleagues who have said to me, yes, I think you're right, but I'm afraid if I vote that way, I will be defeated. Now, I lament that, but I understand it, and I think that's what happened this time. For instance, I think a number of Southern members of the House were boxed in when Sam Nunn took the lead. If you go back, when President Clinton, President-elect, or even candidate Clinton made this pledge, no one anticipated that Sam Nunn was going to become a crusader against the rights of gay and lesbian people, which he's become, and a very effective one, because he is seen as a leader on military issues, and as a Georgian, he's very prominent throughout the South. And I know there are Southern Democratic members of the House, white Southern Democrats, who have feared that if they were to vote with President Clinton on this, they could have electoral trouble because people would quote Sam Nunn against them. Now, I sympathize with that. I understand that. You can expect your colleagues to do a lot, but committing political suicide probably goes beyond that. On the other hand, when people come up to me, as they have, and said, well, I hope you don't take this personally, and they have just made virulent anti-gay speeches, that's nonsense. Of course you take it personally. And for people to make these kind of anti-gay remarks and then come up and say, gee, it's not personal, is either extraordinary stupidity or gross hypocrisy or, as in most of the cases of these people, some combination of the two.
My guest is Barney Frank, Democratic congressman from Massachusetts and one of two openly gay members of Congress. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Congressman Barney Frank is my guest. Can I ask you how life changed in Congress for you after you came out?
Oh, life in general changed enormously for the better for me. Trying to compartmentalize your life was very, very difficult. In fact, look, a couple of years ago, I found myself being accused of some things, a couple of which I did do, and I was stupid to do them, most of which I hadn't done, but because of the way I'd lived, I was even vulnerable to the slanders and the lies. And all of those problems for me happened before I fully acknowledged who I was. Now life is much better. It's better in part because I've met someone who I can share my life with, Herb Moses, but it's also better because I'm not worried about, well, may I do this? May I do that? Can I go to this place? Should I answer that question honestly? There's a whole set of pressures about what do I tell them and what do I not tell them that simply dissolved.
What kinds of things are you talking about?
Well, if people ask you, what are you doing for the weekend? If people ask you, what are you doing tonight? If people ask you, well, are you dating someone? I mean, some of these most fundamental questions. People have said, well, why do you want to tell people about it? Well, I think if people stop and think, they will realize it is impossible, absolutely impossible, for anybody to maintain a close personal friendship or even a sort of a moderately friendly relationship with someone and not tell them about your sexuality if you're going to be honest with them. What did you do last night? What are you doing next summer? Who are you socializing with? Have you ever been married? I mean, there's a whole range of questions that we ask each other to which the answers are inevitably indicative of, in part, of one's sexual orientation. As far as the Congress is concerned, I must tell you that my colleagues in Congress have been, I believe, quite sensible and civilized about all this. One or two right-wing Republicans reacted in a personally negative way, and the need no longer to pretend to be polite to them is not something I miss.
Before you were out in the Congress, did you have to go through charades like taking women to political dinners and things like that?
No, I wouldn't do that. There was a period in my life when I did things like that, but it was before I got to Congress. When I came to Congress, I had decided I wasn't going to engage in that kind of activity. I did not, when I was in Congress, ever consciously or deliberately mislead people. I rather, for a while, tried to avoid the subject. And then I wasn't avoiding the subject. Then I was trying to socialize with other men in certain contexts when it might be the reasonable thing to do. But there was a tension because while I was doing that, I wasn't officially acknowledging it. And as you know, the press, on the whole, has this rule that if you don't acknowledge that you're gay or lesbian, they won't mention it unless you happen to get caught doing something illegal. And that has an unfortunate consequence because it means for a lot of the public, the only time they hear about people being gay or lesbian is in some unfortunate context.
So you think a lot of people in the Congress and in the press knew but kept it private for you?
Yes.
You co-sponsored a gay rights bill in, was it 1973?
In 1970, I didn't co-sponsor it. I sponsored it.
Sponsored it. Okay.
I was the first person. I was elected to the State House of Representatives in 1972, and I sponsored the package of gay and lesbian civil rights bills, except we weren't saying lesbian back then, just gay civil rights bills. Lesbians were, in lawyers' terms, I guess, a lesser-included category in that. But the lesser in terms of numbers, by the way, not in terms of inherent moral worth.
So what was it like to sponsor this bill while you were still in the closet?
Well, it made me very nervous.
Yeah.
It made me very nervous. But at the time, you know, you get into one of these sorts of things where it's like being in the old barbershop where you had mirrors on both sides of the wall and you get an infinite set of reflections. Well, people would say, well, wait a minute. If he were gay, he wouldn't introduce that bill because then he would think we would think he was gay. But then other people said, aha, but if he was gay, he would introduce it because he would think that we would think that he wouldn't introduce it if he were gay because we'd think he was gay. So, and by the time people got through volleying that one back and forth, you figure the hell with it.
You're from New Jersey, right?
Yes, I am.
What I find, one of the things I find really interesting about you is that you sound so much like you're from the New York greater metropolitan area, and you represent Massachusetts.
Yeah, I do. You know, some people have different susceptibility to accents. I have an older sister, Ann Lewis, who many people are familiar with, and Ann is much more adaptable when she lives in the South. You know, her her speaking patterns changed. Mine haven't changed much. I don't like to think about why. Someone told me once, they asked Henry Kissinger's younger brother, and they said, well, it was his older brother. He said, you and Henry both came here from Germany, and you've lived here the same amount of time, and in fact, you were older when you got here, and still is. How come you have no accent and Henry still has an accent? And he said, well, that's because I listen to people. And so maybe Anne listens better. But no, my accent has sort of stayed that way. And within Massachusetts, look, I think we sometimes stereotype the voters unfairly. We talk about stereotypes. By the normal standards, I think there would have been reasons why voters wouldn't have voted for me. And I have found sometimes people in my business think that you have to approach the voters in a certain kind of circumscribed way and sort of abide by certain unfortunate rules. And my experience has been in Massachusetts that that people are, in fact, much more open to differences of a superficial sort and much more willing to listen if you talk honestly to them. I have found people not insisting that you agree with them on every issue or that you be like them in every surface way, as long as they think you're being honest and they're fundamentally in agreement with you.
One last question. Do you feel that this was an issue in which you were differing from a lot of gay activists because you were recommending more of a compromise than a lot of activists were willing to accept? Is this one of the few times for you when you have felt that you were perhaps at odds in a way with gay activists?
No, not any more than in a number of other areas. In principle, I have been, and in goals and in the fundamental moral stance, I am on the same side. But I often find myself, and you alluded to my book, which I appreciate, although I did see it remaindered in the bookstore in Boston.
Terrible feeling, isn't it?
Well, it's a year and a half old, and it was a fairly topical one. But I do feel that there's this unfortunate intellectual dichotomy that people subscribe to and shouldn't, between those who are idealistic, that is, who are committed to accomplishing a set of public policy goals, who believe that it's important to be in politics because you want to change things in a certain philosophically determined way, and those who are pragmatic, those who worry about outcomes. I don't understand that distinction. I literally don't. I mean, I understand that as an empirical fact, but I reject it logically, because the more you are concerned with changing public policy to accomplish certain values, then it seems to me the more you are obligated to worry about how effective you are. Because if politics is about important moral and value-laden questions, which I believe it is, then you're obligated to try as hard as you can to fix it. But unfortunately, there is that distinction. So I have often found myself, frankly, more concerned with kind of moral goals than some of the other people who are interested in the political pragmatics, and more concerned with trying to achieve outcomes than some of my friends who have a very strong moral sense. So it's not the first, and I'm sure it won't be the last time, that I found myself sort of resisting that dichotomy and to some extent disagreeing with people who took either one or the other side of the picture.
Barney Frank, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Barney Frank is a congressman from Massachusetts. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, riding the sound of an ocean's wave. We talk with Dick Dale about inventing the sound that became known as surf guitar. He influenced several generations of players, and Leo Fender had to build a special amp to withstand the volume that Dale pushed through it. Also, writer Anne Lamott teaches her son Sam something about death and life. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. An Israeli soldier was killed and three others were injured in a clash today with guerrillas in southern Lebanon. Fighting between Israel and the pro-Iranian Hezbollah continued throughout the day. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Israeli warplanes and artillery attacked Hezbollah and Palestinian targets throughout Lebanon with more than 800 shells during the day. Reports from Lebanon said there was widespread damage and many casualties. In the afternoon, Hezbollah fired more than 70 Katyusha rockets at northern Israel, lightly injuring one woman and causing extensive property damage. The Israeli cabinet met to consider further steps in Lebanon. At least now, a large-scale Israeli ground invasion seems unlikely. But Israeli officials say they cannot tolerate continued Katyusha attacks, and the heavy barrage on Lebanon will continue. Arab states condemned Israel, and Syria accused Israel of trying to derail the Middle East peace process days before U.S. Secretary of State Warren Christopher is due in the region. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Secretary of State Warren Christopher is expected to go ahead with plans to visit the Middle East later this week, despite new fighting there. A spokesman said that he was aware of no changes in the secretary's travel plans. Christopher is now in Singapore and meetings there with officials of Southeast Asian nations. On Capitol Hill, Republicans will try to block passage of legislation in both the House and Senate tomorrow in an effort to portray Democrats as taxers and spenders. The GOP aims to stop passage of flood relief and the president's national service program unless the new spending is offset by cuts. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Republicans are apparently willing to risk appearing as the guardians of gridlock they've been dubbed. Tomorrow, in separate votes, the House will attempt to move flood relief, and the Senate will try to shut off debate to pass national service. In the House, Republicans have charged that flood relief shouldn't be considered emergency spending, that instead corresponding budget cuts should be offered to pay for the disaster. In the Senate, Republicans are opposing national service, saying that it's typical of new Democratic spending programs that will require a new bureaucracy to manage. The White House and congressional Democrats say it's a GOP smokescreen. White House officials say the Republican effort is to keep the president from winning any victory this close to consideration of his economic plan. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
According to Italian news reports, UN forces in Somalia killed at least six people after armed gunmen fired on a UN post. The UN puts the number of dead at three. The exchange of gunfire occurred last night, and according to reports, a helicopter fired after a battle truck carrying gunmen fired at the post in the capital. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 21 points to close at 37.67, a record high. This is NPR News. Russian President Boris Yeltsin has eased away from a move by the central bank to do away now with the Russian ruble. Yeltsin says that there will be more time given for residents to trade old rubles for new banknotes. Over the weekend, the central bank said only banknotes printed this year would be valid for purchases and gave consumers 2 weeks to exchange old bills for new ones. The move to fight inflation has panicked Russians and created a new government crisis. Under his latest order, citizens have until August 31st to exchange old notes for new ones, and some smaller denominations will remain valid to buy items. Inflation in Moscow is running at 20% a month. Government officials also want to liquidate billions of old rubles outside of Russia's control in other former Soviet republics. A study by the consumer advocate group Public Citizen reports that seriously mentally ill patients in the Canadian province of British Columbia get far better health care than similar patients in the United States. NPR's Patricia Naiman reports.
In the first study of its kind, researchers measured the quality of hospital care, rehabilitation, and housing for patients suffering severe mental illnesses like schizophrenia and manic depression. Across the board, researchers found that care in the Canadian province is more comprehensive than in any U.S. state. Outreach is exemplary, says the report, with teams of mental health workers identifying patients, finding them treatment, and following up on their care. Patients also receive a wide range of social services, including housing, job training, and treatment for substance abuse. As a result, Canadian patients are rehospitalized and arrested less than patients in the U.S. British Columbia spends more per person on mental health than most U.S. states. I'm Patricia Naiman reporting.
This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The surf music sound of the 60s was created by my guest, Dick Dale. He never had any top 40 hits himself, but his twangy staccato guitar sound and his fast, flashy picking inspired generations of rock guitarists. And his band, the Deltones, was the focus of the music scene that grew up around the California surf culture of the late 50s and early 60s. Dale played in the films Beach Party and Muscle Beach Party, and the recent campy sequel, Back to the Beach. He doesn't surf anymore. In fact, he doesn't even live near the beach. He lives in the desert. But he's revived his surf sound on the new album Tribal Thunder. His sidemen are younger musicians who've played with XTC, Tom Waits, and Chris Isaak. This track is called The Eliminator. Dale, welcome to Fresh Air. Do you think that you've been influenced by some of the younger guitarists who've been influenced by you?
Well, it's kind of funny. A Guitar Player magazine once asked me, who was your influence? And I said, Hank Williams. And they said, Hank Williams doesn't play electric guitar. But that's who it was. And music to me is like a facet in my life. I love many things. I've trained lions and tigers, raised them for 30 years, and been in the martial arts for 30 years, been flying airplanes, and just doing so many things that are very interesting, and music was just one of them. And I was raised, actually, listening to the big band era, you know, like Guy Lombardo, Harry James, and the first person that I really listened to was Gene Krupa on drums, and that's where I get this heavy staccato drumming effect on playing. Like Mick Fleetwood of Fleetwood Mac once said to me, watching me, he said, my God, he says, you're the most percussive guitarist I've ever seen in my life. You look like you're playing drums. And I do. I'm playing all the different parts of the drums when I play my guitar. So actually, drums was my first, and Gene Krupa was my first big influence.
Some of the surf music stars didn't really surf, most notably the Beach Boys. But you did. You actually did surf. Is there a connection between the sounds that you'd hear surfing and the kind of music you were playing?
Yes, the sounds were actually compared to my lions and tigers and the ocean, the power of my tigers and the power of the ocean. When I would get, you know, thrown across a cage, you know, with one blow, or seeing the cat go with 2,200 pounds per square inch bite through a stainless steel pan, and you just marvel at man cannot control that, and then you get out in a wave, and then you get out and you stop paddling, and you're facing a 6-footer or an 8-footer, and let alone a 10-footer. It is the most frightening thing in the world, and you just have to just dig down and go for it. And then when you get sucked up and taken over, you never feel strength like that in your life, and you just can't stop that power, so you must ride with it. And that's when I learned to really go with the flow of everything in life, and the waves did create my feelings of that sound, that ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka-ticka. It was like the lip of a wave coming over the top of my head. I'd stick my finger in the wall and get my ear up as close as I could, getting in a tube, or then doing a bottom turn and missing it and getting sucked up over the top and being just crunched right through your board. And in those days, we used the big 10-footers, you know.
Did the sounds of the ocean make you want to get that loud amplified sound that you wanted?
Yeah, it's a combination of the ocean and the roar of my tigers and lions, and just putting it all together, that force. And the ocean just has the two sounds. It has the one that comes over the top of your head. It's a lacy sound. And then it has that bottom rumbling sound. And then it has that wipeout sound. And with my big 60-gauge strings, like most guitar players are using 7s and 8s and 9s, the slinkies, you know, and 10s, my thinnest string is a 14 unwound. And then I use two 18 unwounds for my second and third string. And then my fourth string, I use a 38 wound. And my fifth, I use a 48. And then I use a 58 or a 60, whichever ones I can get.
So this is like really thick strings you're using. And that gives it a deeper sound?
Yeah, it gives it a big, Joel Sullivan calls them bridge cables. It gives you a real, fat, thick sound, along with the combination of what goes into this amplifier and the guitar and the speaker. It's a combination of everything. But playing them is very hard. It's very painful because it's like taking your finger and going up and down, you know, the sidewalk with it. And that's why when I make faces, everybody goes, "Oh man, you make the neatest faces." I go, "That's pain. That's not."
Now, what about the picking style that you developed?
The picking came from my father's side of the family. His mother and father were born in Beirut, Lebanon, and my mother's side of the family were born in Poland. So I was subject to the musical styles of both countries. But when I had that influence of that Arabic music, when I came to California, a kid asked me, he said, "Can you play on one string?" Because I was playing what I called rockabilly. And I developed a rock-a-tuck style of strumming on the guitar because I didn't have a whole band. So I would go, tink-a-da, 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 tink-a-da. So now, when I did that, this little boy, he was probably about 10, and at my first show at the Rendezvous Ballroom in Balboa, that's when it opened up. We had like 17 surfers and the kids I was surfing with. And he says, "Can you play on one string?" And I didn't know what to do. And I says, "Well, come back tomorrow night, and I'll have something for you," just to get rid of them. And then when I went home, I says, "Oh, my God, I'm going to get caught. I'm going to be found out that I'm a fake, you know, that I can't play on one string or something." And I thought, and I says, "Mizzaloo." And Mizzaloo was played very slowly. I went and quadrupled the sound. I went because I wanted a machine gun staccato picking style, which is very difficult to play because you have to keep your meter properly. And then as a result, you break stainless steel strings and you melt picks down, two or three of them in a song, they melt. And that's why I have a special pick holder that I reach down and I throw one out when I play and I pick one up and I continue melting. But that's how I get that sound. It's like a machine gun style, picking style.
Well, let's hear your original recording of Mizzaloo, which you made back in 1962.
Yeah, I think the original people that did it are probably turning over in their grave when they heard it the way I play it.
Dick Dale has reissued on Rhino Records, and Dick Dale also has a new album out. What was the scene like on the beach when you started surfing and playing?
We would go down to the beach at 5 o'clock in the morning to get the early glass off, and build a fire to keep warm. We never had wetsuits at that time. So we froze in the water. Our legs would turn blue. We'd beat on our legs to stop the pain. And we just hoped that the next wave, waiting for the next wave, and you just beat on our thighs, just to keep the pain from going away. It was just that everybody had a camaraderie about them. And basically in California, everyone that went to a Dick Dale dance, we all met at the beach and we would all surf. And we'd just surf all day, come out of the water, break and have a sandwich and go back in and surf to the evening glass offs. And it was just a cleanliness, everybody was safe. Everybody could walk the beaches safe. Now you can't go anywhere. That's why I live in the high desert.
My guest is Dick Dale, the king of the surf guitar. We're after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is guitarist Dick Dale. He's revived his surf guitar sound on his new album, Tribal Thunder. When you started playing, you wanted a really loud sound, and you couldn't get it loud enough. And you knew Leo Fender, the guitar maker, and what you worked together to get an amplifier that would give you the volume you wanted?
Well, what happened was it wasn't as much as volume. What it was a quality of sound. I wanted to get a fat, thick, deep sound that was very fat, sounding like a big floor tom, a tom-tom. Because once again, listening to the Gene Krupa drumming, and when we never mic'd our amplifiers, we never had mics in front of amplifiers, so the amplifier had to sound thick and pure on its own merit. And with Leo making just amplifiers that are only 10-inch speakers, you cannot get a sound out of a 10-inch speaker that gives you a fat, thick sound. So when Leo Fender would call me to come to his factory, he said, "Dick, I've got the sound. I'd go up there and I'd play this amplifier that he'd have, and it would be really loud, and really powerful. And I go, "Wow, that's sounds great." But then when I took it to the Rendezvous Ballroom and got it on the stage, and there's 4,000 people out there, all of a sudden their clothes would suck up the sound and suck up the thickness and the bassness of this sound, and I wouldn't have any more power or any more depth of sound. So I kept trying to tell Leo that, and we kept on making all these adjustments with output transformers, with speakers, and that's how I blew up over 48 speakers and amplifiers. They'd catch on fire. The speakers would freeze. The speakers would tear from the coils. We went to Lansing Company and said, "Listen, we need a beefier speaker that'll handle the big bass strings, that'll handle this output transformer." And then Leo finally came to, and Freddie Travers came to the Rendezvous, stood in the middle of 4,000 people to watch what I was doing, and they looked at each other and they said, "Now I know what Dick's trying to tell me." So he went back to the drawing board, came up and invented the Dick Dale Showman amplifier and the dual Showman amplifier with the 15-inch Lansing speaker. That was the end result of the sound, and along with the creations that we did on the Stratocaster guitar, making it a real thick body, because the thicker the wood, the more pure the sound.
Right. Let me play one of your early records. This dates back to 1962. It's Surf Beat. You want to say something about the record? And right before we started the interview, you told me you hate your early records. Do you hate this record?
Well, I don't hate the song. No, I don't hate the song. I hate the way it was recorded, because it just wasn't big and fat like I play, and no one's ever been able to capture that. In high tone, this is the first time in my life that I ever consented to coming in, like 30 years of recording, I come back from 30 years or something, and they said, "Dick, do what you want." And this is the first time in my life I ever had an engineer wanting to please and say, "Hey, don't worry about the time being spent," like Hightone said, "don't worry about it. We're going to put everything into how long it takes to get you happy, to get that sound." And the end result was no fancy overdubbing. Ry Cooter was asked by Scotty, he said, "How do I record Dick Dale?" And Ry Cooter said, "Don't infect Dick Dale's brain with anything going on today, because he don't know what's going on today. He's up in the mountain someplace, and he could care less. Just plug him in, turn the tape recorder on, and let him go, and don't let the needles go into the red, and just record it." And that's exactly what we did. And it was nothing but just creativity right from beginning to end.
So you don't like the way you were recorded on the early records?
No, it did not have, it sounded too tinny, and I was too ashamed to play them to anybody.
You were ashamed to play your own records?
I never played my own records. I never even kept them in the house.
Hmm.
Because I listened to Hank Williams instead.
Well, okay, so I'm going to play it.
Does that sound strange?
Well, yeah. But I'll be the one to play. I'll play your 1962 recording of Surf Beat. That's Dick Dale recorded in 1962. It's interesting. I mean, here you are like Mr. Surf Guitar and everything. You're living in the desert.
Yeah.
Pretty paradoxical. What's it like for you to live so far from the ocean?
Well, you know, out of sight, out of mind. And the thing lies is I almost got squished away from the ocean because the population is just, it's just like somebody built a shoebox and put a bunch of mice in it, and the mice kept growing and growing, and the shoebox stays the same. So it's so sad that the population is just exploding, and everyone's running around with their heads chopped off or something. So I wanted peace. So I went up to the high desert, and if I don't speak, I can hear my ears ring. And it's so wonderful up there. It's like living in a tomb. And it just gives you another 20 years to your life because it's so beautiful with the desert creatures. And it's a place to raise my 17-month-old son. And it's just peaceful, so peaceful.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. I can't wait to get back and out there and do the whole thing.
Here's more from Dick Dale's new album, Tribal Thunder, on High Tone Records. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, what do you have on the conflict between Israel and Lebanon?
Hi, Terry. Linda Gradstein reports from Israel. Two Israeli soldiers have been killed in Israel's self-declared security zone. Hezbollah, the pro-Iranian group, is promising more attacks if Israel does not leave Lebanon. Israel has launched a two-day offensive, Operation Accountability, designed to stop guerrilla attacks from Lebanon. And Lebanon is asking for a meeting of the United Nations Security Council. Other stories, economic rumblings over the ruble in Moscow. Mike Schuster has a report. And Carmen Delzell with some thoughts on how the Salvation Army is trying to help folks hurt by the flood in Missouri.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. A lot of new parents are determined to make their kids' childhood different from their own. Writer Anne Lamott is back with a journal entry about her life as a single mother raising her almost 4-year-old son, Sam.
Sam saw his first dead person last month. Two friends of ours had a baby who died, and we went to spend the morning with the two of them and the body of their son. He was 5 months old and weighed 8 pounds, down from the 10 he weighed at birth. He wore a white baptismal gown and lay in a big basket on top of his crib, covered with flower petals from the waist down, white as a rose. There were flowers and shrines everywhere, statues of the Buddha and pictures of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, because his mother is a Buddhist, and of Jesus, because his father is a Christian. Bryce looked like a small, concerned angel from someplace snowy. None of us, including Sam, could take our eyes off of him. He looked like God. "You what?" my relatives asked when I mentioned this. "You took Sam to see what? As in, what will you take him to see next? Brain surgery?" I couldn't explain why I think it was right, except that I was taught to be terrified of sickness and death, and I honestly believe it compromised my life a great deal. And of course, I want better for Sam. Lots of my friends have died of cancer and AIDS, but Bryce was the first dead person Sam ever saw. Sam didn't seem scared. Maybe it was because Bryce looked so beautiful in death. He was an old pro at it. He had died during delivery and was resuscitated 7 minutes later, and so was born a second time, but it turned out that he had been gone too long. His eyes were deep gray and always opened, and he never cried, or for that matter smiled, or even blinked. Bryce's mother's Buddhist friends called him Cloud Boy, because he was suspended between heaven and earth, not quite here, not quite there. His father's Christian friends did a lot of the cooking. Everyone held him and rocked him. Sam and I spent a lot of time reading to him, mostly Dr. Seuss. He's a good baby, Sam assured Bryce's parents one day. Not knowing how on earth they would take care of him, they brought Bryce home when he was 3 weeks old, because they didn't want him to die at the hospital. They just wanted him to be home with them and their friends. It was an amazing thing to be a part of. Some people saw Bryce as a tragedy, thought his parents were crazy for not leaving him at the hospital. The rest of us felt incredibly sad, but also that we were in the presence of something holy, something that didn't have to do with personality or character or age. He's a good baby, Sam told me one day in the car after we'd been reading to Bryce for a while, but he's a little funky. When Bryce died, his parents called us and asked if Sam and I would come over. They were sad but okay. Sam brought the baby two presents that morning, which he lay in the basket. One was a ball, in case you get to play catch on the other side. The other was a small time travel car from Back to the Future. Bryce's parents and I are still scratching our heads over that one. After we left that morning, I took Sam to the local bowling lanes. It was another first for him, and it was all so ridiculous and real that it too felt sacred. We bowled in the kids' lane for an hour. You took him where? Asked my relatives, and I couldn't really explain why. It had something to do with wanting to shake off the solemnity, with wanting to complete the cycle of life and death. Bowling is life at its most immediate. You fling a ball and the pins fall down, sometimes. And I also wanted to show Sam that the holy goes on, no matter how many balls you fling at it.
Annie Lamott is the author of the new book, Operating Instructions, A Journal of My Son's First Year. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein, research assistance from Louisa Shafia. And we welcome the listeners of station KUOW in Seattle, which recently began broadcasting Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation and the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Bosnia and Somalia have forced us to rethink our responsibilities to civilians caught in war and famine. On the next Fresh Air, we talk to Dr. Kevin Cahill. He worked as a physician for more than three decades in Africa, Latin America, and Asia, dealing with the human catastrophes that follow war and natural disasters. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.